Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. This year's hurricane season is forecast to be about average, while New England is likely to see a warmer and possibly wetter than usual summer. A major factor in those kinds of seasonal predictions is typically ocean temperatures. Now, researchers at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution say they have a better way to make seasonal rainfall predictions, and it's based on salinity rather than temperature of the ocean. Specifically, the salinity off the east coast of the U.S. may predict rainfall in the African Sahel. Ray Schmidt is one of those researchers. He's senior scientist in physical oceanography at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Ray, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Heather.
So why isn't the salinity of the ocean the same everywhere all the time?
Well, I'd like to sort of go over the global water cycle. And I think most people have an incorrect picture of the global water cycle, what they learned in fifth grade geography class. And it's usually depicted, trying to depict all the processes that happen on land, snow in the mountains, melting into lakes and rivers, and eventually flowing back to the sea. But the amount of ocean that they show in that diagram is just makes up a tiny bit of it. There's this little bitty ocean in the corner.
Yeah, you see a bunch of land with a little bit of ocean next to it.
Yes, and that's really inconsistent because most of the water cycle is over the ocean. The ocean covers,
and of course, the ocean covers
71% of the planet, and so you have all this vast evaporation going on over the ocean, and most of the rainfall is on the ocean itself. And the numbers are huge. For instance, it's 100,000 cubic miles per year of water evaporates from the surface of the ocean.
Enough, I can't even imagine what that means in terms of water.
In terms of water amount, it means it would flood the continental U.S., the lower 48, up to a depth of 60 yards.
Wow.
That's 1 year's evaporation from the ocean. But 90% of it falls right back on the ocean. But it doesn't
fall. That's why we don't have 60 yards of water on top of us.
Exactly. And so some places evaporate more than they precipitate, and those are the subtropical high-pressure systems, the Bermuda High that the last gentleman was just talking about. And then in the ocean, there are two places that water ends up going, to low latitudes, the intertropical convergence zone where it rains a lot, and high latitudes where it rains a lot. The British Isles are wet. We know that. So those mid-latitude dry regions export a lot of water and energy. That water represents latent heat energy that powers the atmosphere. It's fuel for atmospheric motions. And about 10% of it goes on land and gets returned to the ocean through the rivers. Now, that vast cycle over the ocean is where we're seeing the greatest evidence for change in the water cycle. One of the tenets of global change, one of the big questions, is how much will the water cycle intensify? And the reason we know it will is basically because we know it's humid in the summer and dry in the winter. And so if you increase the temperature a little bit, you get a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. And this is a property of the water molecule. It's just basic physics. And for each degree centigrade increase in average temperature, you get 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere.
So when you say that the water cycle will intensify, does that mean that it's turning over faster, that there's more evaporation, more precipitation?
Exactly. What is it?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so wet areas should get wetter and dry areas should get drier. And that's hard to see on land because mankind has basically interfered with the terrestrial water cycle to a great extent. We dam rivers. 40% of our freshwater cycles through power plants. We pump up groundwater. So we've really modified the terrestrial water cycle to a great extent. And it's hard to tell to see if there's been any trends. I mean, we can see some things. Storms tend to be, our rain, and particularly in the Northeast, it's been getting somewhat wetter, but the pattern of the rainfall has been changing to be more intense. We get a little more water, but it's more concentrated. But in the ocean, we have salinity records. We have pretty good salinity records, especially for the North Atlantic, going back 60 years or so. And we can see that the salty areas are getting saltier and the fresh areas are getting fresher. Now, those salty areas are right under the Bermuda High, that subtropical
high
pressure system.
That's the areas where it's evaporating a lot.
Evaporating,
it's leaving the salt behind.
It leaves the salt behind, and those areas are getting saltier. And the other areas where it rains a lot, those are getting fresher. So this pattern of salinity changes in the ocean has emerged in the last decade or so. Actually, individual oceanographers have noted it in various oceans for a long time, these trends. But it was a global picture was put together by some good Australian scientists recently. And so we have this picture of intensifying water cycle over the ocean. And so there has to be spill-off on land. And so that pattern is, and the water cycle is something I've been interested in for a long time. And I started to ask the question some years ago, if we can see these trends in the water cycle that are showing up, what about the year-to-year variations? And if there's a little more evaporation from the ocean, so this area gets saltier, the salt being an indicator of the export of water from the region, some of that is going to end up on land. And could there be a relationship between salinity and rainfall on land?
How do you go about answering a question like that? I mean, are you looking at rainfall data for the whole globe, trying to pick out where maybe this rain is ending up? It seems like an immense question to try to take on.
It is a challenging question. I really started looking at it, thinking about it, back in 1993. There were really strong flooding in the Mississippi and Missouri river systems, and that pulse of water made its way back to the ocean. And oceanographers down in Florida and Texas could see this big freshwater anomaly in the Gulf of Mexico, and then it got entrained in the Gulf Stream, and it was going up the East Coast. And I said, well, if all this water has made parts of the ocean fresher, sometime before the flooding on land, some part of the ocean had to get saltier. And from our studies of evaporation precipitation patterns, we know that the areas of net evaporation and net precipitation happen to be about equal. So if, say, the state of South Carolina gets a foot of rain and over a month, I know that some equally area part of the ocean lost a foot of water from its surface. The comparable area lost that much water at the surface, and that will generate a salinity signal that we could see even from satellites. We have salinity satellites in space right now. So it's actually something I've been interested in studying for a long time, but it proved difficult to get funding for it. But about 2 years ago, I was able to attract a postdoctoral fellow at the Oceanography Institution. She was a very clever young lady from Duke University named Lifeng Li. And she came and she was funded, and I gave her this problem, and she really struck gold with it.
So we've already given away part of the end of this story, which is that, yes, you can find connections between salinity signals in the ocean and rainfall on land. Is it always the same connection? Is there a patch of ocean where that water comes from when it floods in the Mississippi, or does it come from different places at different times?
Yeah, that's one of the things we're trying to sort out right now. Well, what happened was a few years ago, I organized a big study sponsored by NASA of the salinity maximum in this middle of the North Atlantic. And I always had in mind that the water that was leaving that area and making it salty was ending up in the Amazon. And so I had written some proposals to try to look at that connection. But we never were able to follow through on that. And so when this new researcher arrived, we drew a box around the salinity maximum in the North Atlantic. And I said, the good thing was she was a rainfall expert. And so she knew the data sets and where to look. And I said, well, let's look at the interannual variations in salinity in this patch of ocean and see if we see any correlation with rainfall on land. And it wasn't the Amazon River system. It was in Africa that we saw a correlation. And it was actually the best correlation with salinity in the northeast part of the North Atlantic. But much to our surprise, there was about a three-month lag in the system, and it took a while to puzzle that out, but she also figured that problem out. And it has to do with moisture in the soil. See, water is transformative, and dry soil behaves very differently than wet soil or a wet forest with regard to the previous speaker. If there's enough moisture in the ground, it converts the solar energy that's always pouring in daily into latent heat of evaporation, and that is fuel for atmospheric motion because that drives convection and intensifies storms in the atmosphere. If you just have dry land, you don't have that conversion to latent heat, which fuels atmospheric convection. So what happens in the spring, the North Atlantic gets salty. As the water evaporates, it ends up in a certain region called the Sahel of Africa. And that bit of moisture that comes in the spring from the North Atlantic seeds more convection in the summer, months later, that draws in moisture from the Mediterranean and from the tropical Atlantic. So there's a complicated story of how spring salinities can predict summer rainfall in Africa.
It's not just as simple as the water evaporates up near Britain and it falls down near Africa and we're all done. It's not just a simple circle.
Right, and there's this big delay in it. So then we start looking for more correlations, and we find that salinities off the U.S. East Coast were very good predictors for rainfall in the Midwest. And it's kind of an interesting process there. What happens is if the salinities get high in the spring, you often have flooding in the south, in Louisiana and Texas, and that moisture makes its way northward in the summer. Something called the Great Plains low-level jet sets up and carries the moisture up into the Midwest. And so it was very satisfying. We had done this analysis. We saw this strong correlation based on 60 years of data. And so last year in the spring, I said, well, what's the salinity look like now? And it was very high. So there was a meeting of the American Meteorological Society in June of 2015 in Minnesota. So I went to this meeting and I gave a talk. The title was Predicting Minnesota Rainfall from North Atlantic Salinities. And I told them
that should perk up a few local ears, right?
I hope so. And my prediction proved to be very accurate. They did have a rainy summer.
So why would the salinity necessarily be a better predictor than temperature? Because temperature is part of what's going to determine how much evaporation there is and determine the salinity. Why would it necessarily be a better predictor?
The salinity is an indicator of how much water and energy the ocean has exported from a given region. And what we're finding is certain regions of the ocean seem to have these teleconnections with certain regions of high rainfall on land. And it's complicated, and there are intermediate processes like the soil moisture. And I just wanted to add, with regard to the discussion about the hurricane of 38, he mentioned that it had been a very wet summer. There's an effect called the brown ocean effect that in which, normally if a hurricane goes on dry land, it can't get any more fuel because
right.
There's no moisture.
It slows it down, right?
But if there's enough moisture in the soil and the soil's wet enough and the lakes are full and the rivers are full, a hurricane can actually maintain its strength because there's so much moisture available on the land and the sun has put energy into it. So that's probably why that hurricane didn't die when it hit the coast.
I mean, we tend to talk about it as the hurricane either, is sucking up energy or it's being fed by that kind of...
It's all moisture. Moisture is key. And why is salinity better than temperature? Temperatures in the ocean is subject to, daily variations due to the weather. The salinity is kind of an integrator. It's an averager of what's been going on for the past few months. So it's kind of more of a longer term signal in the surface of the ocean.
So is salinity now being incorporated into more of these seasonal predictions that we tend to get from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and others?
Not yet. Our papers were just published about a month ago, and there is interest in that community, and I'm hoping they'll pick up on it. And, we're going to some of these climate prediction workshops and things. So hopefully that'll continue.
Have you seen, in looking through, 60-plus years of data that you've had to sift through to tease apart these connections, can you see changes in these relationships or changes this intensification of the water cycle that you said you would expect from climate change?
Well, the key thing is that we do have these long records, and there is a trend. We do remove the trend before we look at the year-to-year variations. And, it could be that the patterns that we're coming up with now will change in the future. And that's one of the key things. We have to maintain these records for a long period of time. And that's one of my other interests in how do we sustain good climate records for generations that it's really required.
Well, so what are some of your ideas? I mean, what are the changes that we need institutionally to be able to really track and understand climate change going forward?
It is an institutional challenge. The average scientist's career is 30 or 40 years, and there's not much reward for trying to maintain a climate record for 30 years, and which only after 30 years can you say something about your data. It's much easier to do a short-term experiment. And so there's institutional things that have to change, but there's also a funding issue. NOAA is the primary keeper of weather records, and they've had a hard time with Congress lately. There's kind of a war on science going on, and if it's called climate, then Congress wants to kill it. So for instance, the El Nino monitoring array in the Pacific had fallen down to 40% data return a few years ago, just as a big El Nino was setting up. So we don't have the institutions, we don't have the funding to maintain our long-term records. And we're talking, it's kind of an intergenerational problem. What do we owe the future? It's a challenging question for all of mankind. And a few of us have developed this fantasy that we could get a big endowment going to maintain these long-term records. And if you look at philanthropy in the U.S., something like $500 billion is given away philanthropically in the U.S., but only 2% of it goes to the environment. It goes to religion and health and education. And so we're very self-focused as a species.
But of course, all of those things are part of climate change as well. Is there the possibility for some sort of cross-fertilization there?
I would think. I mean, the more we know about the climate system, the better we will be at predicting the future state of it. And that affects agriculture. It affects economies. My fantasy is something like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. We need a Jeff Bezos Earth Institute, a Sergey Brin Earth Institute, some billionaire, and there are over 1,000 billionaires on the planet. Some billionaire's got to get it into his mind that he wants to, make this statement, do something for the planet. In a way, the human species right now, we're sort of doing... I don't know if you've seen this internet meme called "Death by Selfie." we're so focused on ourselves, The "Death by Selfie" is where a guy goes to the top of a mountain, takes a picture of himself with his phone right before he falls off the mountain,
right.
Or in front of a lion right before he gets mauled. We're so focused on being healthy and holy and well educated. All these things are very carbon positive and not really helping the planet. Meanwhile, we got this slowly creeping disaster of climate change sneaking up on us.
Hopefully we will be able to do something about that in time. That's Ray Schmidt, Senior Scientist in Physical Oceanography at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Ray, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.